Previously on Beta.
Gentlemen of the press, get ready, because you are about to witness the biggest news event of the year.
Like, gun, what is it? Gun? Gangbusters? Gangbusters, that's it.
That was Joe's first confrontation with the law.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Scott Thompson and Dave Foley join us to celebrate the comedic Canadian genius of the Kids in the Hall and their rebooted Prime Video series.
We never thought we were being subversive or edgy or anything like that. We just thought we were funny. You know, we thought we were the funniest thing in the world.
Also, author Coda Clute on his unexpected friendship with the innovative visionary Frank Zappa.
This man was such a incredible force of creativity and insight and intelligence combined.
But first, the Orson Welles of obscenity, the Prince of Puke, and the Titan of transgressive film, John Waters. He's a man of many nicknames. John is best known for such films as Hairspray, Pink Flamingos, and Serial Mom. He's also the author of best-selling books like Role Models, Carsick, and Mr. Know-It-All. But being John Waters means always exploring unexplored territory, which leads us to his latest project, his debut novel. It's called Liar Mouth, a feel-bad romance, and it's every bit as filthy, perverse, and hilarious as you could imagine. Maybe even more so. John joined us from his apartment in San Francisco to tell us why, at this age and point in his career, he decided to write a novel.
I decided to write a novel because I wanted to challenge myself. I had never written one, even though I had written lots of movies, which are fiction, of course. I had never written one, and I just wanted to challenge myself, just like I did when I hitchhiked across the country by myself at 66 for another book. Each book is a challenge, but I wanted to be a different kind. You know, I read novels all the time, so it was something I always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Your protagonist is named Marcia Sprinkle. Can you tell us about her?
Well, Marcia is a suitcase thief, and she has a fake chauffeur that is her crime partner, but his salary is he gets to have sex with her once a year. But today is that year, and she, as she said, is no man's used up calendar. And they get caught during their first scam on this day at the airport, and they have to split up and run. So it's about three generations of women that are sort of hostile to each other, but I'm asking you to make them the heroine of the book. All the women in this book I love, and I think the readers do too, even though they're kind of nasty and they would not be heroines in real life at all. But that's all my work is like that. So my readers won't be surprised that I have a villain as the main character that I hope you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because that's exactly what happened to me, what I experienced while I was reading it. Marcia comes across, like on the surface, as a very unlikable character, but I found myself really liking her.
Well, she had a reason. You find the reason that's as ludicrous as the rest of the book, as why she is so bitter. And she does change some. I'm not sure she's ever sorry for her behavior ever. As most of my feminine characters who might be considered villains are never sorry for their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, I think that again, that is like something that makes them quite likable. I've heard that you sent Liar Mouth to a sensitivity reader. I didn't even know there was such a thing. What kind of feedback did you get?
Well, I didn't know there was such a thing either until Bruce Wagner, a writer I like very much, who I
oh, yeah.
He writes very dark novels, so and he told me that his last novel, that they sent it to a sensitivity editor, which publishers all do now, and the sensitivity editor would not let him use the word fat, even though the character was purposely trying to eat as much as she could so she would be the largest human being living on the earth. And he got so furious, he just published this whole novel for free on YouTube. So I knew this was coming. I didn't send it to one. My publisher did. And the sensitivity ever never called us back, never would return phone calls. So she quit or dropped dead. I don't know what happened. But my editor is pretty great, Jonathan Galassi, and my agent, Bill Clegg, and all the women that work for me. I have three generations of women. So we became our own sensitivity editors. And we found that anything touchy, by making it even more ludicrously politically correct, made it funny and made it a satire on that too. So the threat of it maybe made the book better. even though I made it probably more crazy at the same time. But yes, that happens. It's like now also when you're making a movie, they have intimacy counselors if there's a sex scene. Now, I always hated filming sex scenes because it's so embarrassing. But I did have scenes in like a Dirty Shame movie where extras had that never met each other had to make out for like hours in the background for scenes. They'd start laughing. But today you'd have to have shrinks there practically to advise them how to do it. So it's more complicated these days, definitely. I've always made fun of the rules of whatever supposed outsider community I live in, whether it was hippies to political correctness. And the values are always the same. I make fun of the rules that I have to live to in the world I've chosen to live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you continue to do that with great effect in Liarmouth. In keeping with your reputation as an equal opportunity satirist, your novel includes a trampoline park cult led by Marsha's daughter, Poppy Samuels, and you've got dogs and cats that are dealing with gender and species identity disorders. Can you tell us a bit about these storylines and why you wanted to include them?
Well, the trampoline fanatics, I'm trying to find a minority that is very serious and feels that they are discriminated against, but they have to bounce at all times in real life. So it is, what is the limit? All minorities and cults believe they're right, but is it ever going too far? And I'm not saying, I mean, they're really crazy about bouncing. They have cars that don't have shocks, so they're still bouncing up and down in their cars. Right. They bounce in place when they're standing in restaurants, causing attention and derision. So I'm wondering, are they discriminated against? I mean, so I'm trying to find new minorities that don't exist and have fun with them. The grandmother in the movie, in the book, is a plastic surgeon for pets. And I believe that is around the corner. That will happen. And she is so crazy that she has lifted and changed her dog so many times that it begins to believe it's a cat. And so is transitioning into a cat through facial surgery as a pet.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what kinds of reaction you're getting to Liarmouth in the cities you're visiting.
It's been great. You know, we've gotten really nice reviews, including the New York Times, which was such a relief and meant a lot to me. The audiences seem younger and younger and younger, which is very encouraging to me. And people have been coming out fully to get their book signed and everything. I do it behind plexiglass, kind of like a bail bonds place, but they slide the book under and then they turn around and do the picture. And it's kind of like the jail booth in Crybaby. They can grind up on it and stuff. It's good for photo ops.
Art imitates life, I guess. Yeah. Is life imitating art. Yeah. With the current mania for banning book these days, I guess it's only a matter of time until Liarmouth is banned. Maybe it's happened already. Are you looking forward to that?
Well, banning any book today is the best publicity you could ever get it. I doubt many teachers are going to be teaching this in kindergarten to fourth grade. I don't think that's where they get banned so much.
That's true, yeah.
I really don't think that'll be a problem. But it is very true that I keep my patriotism on the down low. But America is a great country because I've been allowed to have this career for 50 years. In the 60s, Lenny Bruce went to prison for saying the F word. You know, I would get the death penalty for this book if it had come out in the 60s. And today it is accepted and it's just American humor. And I think I'm not mean-spirited. I don't think this book is. I think that I make fun of things I love. So at the same time, I wish it would get banned, I guess. But who would ban it, really? If I had to worry about somebody banning it today, it might be rich college students, not the old censors I had, which were dumb old white people.
That's a good point. Yeah. It was interesting. I was struck by your mentioning that you've been lucky to have the 50-year career you've had here in America. Do you think there's any other country where you could have had the success that you've had here?
France has been the greatest to me always. My last book, Mr. Know-It-All, was really a success there. There were subway ads and everything for it. It was amazing. I think Europe has always been pretty great. I think France has been the closest, and England has always been the closest to my sense of humor, with Italy being the furthest away, because they dub movies and they always change the titles. Like Hairspray there was called Fat is Beautiful. I don't think that's an improvement.
Not at all. And you mentioned you had kind of a slip of the tongue earlier where you accidentally said movie, but this book reads like a novel, but it also is very, very cinematic. And I'm curious if you have any plans, any desire to turn it into a film?
Well, my agent told me there's been nibbles on film rights, which is kind of hilarious if somebody actually had to buy the film rights from me to get me to make the movie. That would be adding an extra pay level. So I am all for it. It is very cinematic. I can't help. I think that way. Three acts, action. I don't want the people to ever be bored. And I want to have fun. And the main reason with movies or books for me is always to make people smile at things that maybe make them nervous in real life. So, yes, this could be a movie. It would probably get an NC-17 rating. But maybe it's time to finally have an NC-17 hit again at the box office. Midnight Cowboy was. There were hit movies that are NC-17. Now, even to say that word, if you're trying to make a movie, is almost impossible.
Hmm. Who would you cast as Marcia if this were to be made into a film? Do you have someone in mind?
Well, I mean, you know, Marcia's 40 years old, and who I always think about it is somebody that's a little older, though, as Gina Gershon. I can always imagine. I always try to follow her.
Yeah. Great idea. Yeah, that's great. Well, I hope that happens. I really hope that happens. Was it difficult to transition from writing screenplays to writing a novel?
No, it's the same thing. You just have to go in that room every day and do it. It was not different to me. It's a different kind of thing because you can write such detail that you don't have to show in dialogue what you have to do in a movie always. But the process to me is the same. I think up the title. I think up the names of the characters. I think up the characters. And then I go through with one critic who gave me a bad review once when my movie said, and then I think up the plot, my clothesline to hang my filthy wash. And that is true, though, if you think of it that way. It is true. So the plot is what makes a hit. It really does. In a movie or book or anything, you have to have a plot that keeps the page turning. And some there are books that are the opposite of that, where nothing happens, that are beautifully written, that I like. But it's not the kind of... I'm trying to make a book that is just like my movies, that is hopefully makes you laugh and uses some wit and surprises you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I should ask you while I have the chance, it's the 50th anniversary of Pink Flamingos this year. How do you think it holds up?
Well, I just watched it a lot because Criterion is putting out this beautiful new version of it. Wait till you see it. Wait till you see the extras. We went back in the locations today where the people live now that maybe didn't know the movie was made in their house and tell them about it. We've got some really funny stuff. So to me, I'm thrilled. It's worse now than it ever was. You know, political correctness and stuff. It's even kind of nastier and ruder, but more ironic that the National Film Registry named it as one of the historic American films this year. I never thought that would happen. And I'm very proud, without any irony, that did happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as well, you should be. And you're doing, I've read somewhere, I think that you're doing a commentary track for Criterion, and I don't think it's for Pink Flamingos, some other...
I did it for Pink Flamingos. No, I used. I know. I think I did for that one. I did interviews, but I did one for a long time ago for The Girl Can't Help It, and I did one for Mommy Dearest too. I think those are the two, and I did one for Busby Berkeley movies too. So I've done different commentaries for other people's films in the past, and then they re-release them in different countries and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, what's next for John Waters? Possibly a film adaptation of Liarmouth, but.
The next possibilities are, or maybe a movie that I'm trying to see if it's going to get made, and I can't talk about it because it'll curse it, or another novel, or I think those are probably the next two steps, another movie or another novel. And then my usual stuff I always do, which is I host Mosswood Madness, which is a big punk rock festival in Oakland every July 4th. I'm doing that. I have the John Waters Summer Camp, which is almost completely sold out in the fall for the fifth year in Connecticut. I have 20 City Christmas Tour coming up. I'm doing my spoken word show in Spain, London. So I'm on the road all the time. I'm actually busier than I've ever been in my entire life.
Do you like being that busy, or would you rather have a little more downtime?
Yeah. People say to me, why don't you retire? I think, well, I'll probably drop dead if I did. And then maybe I'll drop dead on stage like that comedian did, or on a plane. You know, that would be a good way. Because at least you're going somewhere, except that I'm in first class now, and they always die first. The only way you live on a plane crash is on the tail when it pops off. But I don't want that seat. I'll stay in first class. It took me 40. I didn't fly in first class until I was 40. I ain't going back, even if the tail pops off.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, because last time I talked to you, it was about your exhibit, Indecent Exposures, at the Baltimore Art Museum. And more recently, the Baltimore Art Museum did this cool thing where they allowed the security guards to show their art. Did you have a chance to check
great.
That out?
Yeah. It was very good. My friend Amy Elias, it was her idea. She's on the board with me. I did go, and it was a great idea. And one of the guards told a great story in Art Forum about when she was guarding my piece 12 something and a dirty foot, which is one of the most obscene pieces I ever did, how much fun she had watching the older ladies come around the corner and look at it. And she said, they stayed the longest. So guards have really good stories about what it's like to work in a museum. And imagine standing there all day. And some great artists started out that way. I mean, Robert Ryman, who did all white paintings, he was a museum guard. Jeff Koons worked at the desk in MoMA trying to get people to sign up to be members. So artists have started working in museums and they end up there. It's a great story.
Mm-hmm, definitely. John Waters, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Liarmouth and on continuing to push the envelope until there's nothing left but itsy bitsy, teeny weeny, tattered pieces of paper blowing in the wind.
Oh, what a great quote. Thank you so much.
John Waters is a film director, an actor, and a visual artist. And now he's a novelist. You can find out more about John and his debut novel, Liarmouth, at WPR.org/beta.
99.9% of performers would not like someone throwing them donuts from the audience, especially donuts that were part of a bit that ruined their show. But these guys liked it.
Coming up, Scott Thompson and his fellow kid in the hall, Dave Foley, join us to talk about their hilarious Prime Video revival. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The next stop on our tour is the Marble Faun. This is the very first bar that I ever worked at. Do you know that I was 17 years old?
So you were underage.
Well, technically, but it was the 80s, wartime. All hands on deck.
Were you a good bartender?
I was the worst. Yet at the end of the night, I took home more tips than a moil.
That's Scott Thompson as one of his iconic characters, Buddy Cole, from the Amazon Prime revival of The Kids in the Hall. That's right, one of Canada's best comedy exports is back in business, baby. And they're as smart, innovative, and good-looking in dresses as they've ever been. Their original series ran on CBC and HBO from 1989 to 1995. And almost 30 years later, they're as fresh and funny as ever. We were fortunate enough to have two of my fellow Canadians, Scott Thompson and Dave Foley, stop by to talk about life as a kid in the hall. As you may or may not know, Scott was the last person to join the troupe, and he has no trouble remembering the first time he saw them perform at the Poor Alex Theatre in Toronto in the fall of 1983.
My friend Darlene Harrison, she took me to a midnight show of The Kids in the Hall, and there were donuts taped under the seat. Yeah, and during the show, about halfway in there, first of all, the moment they started performing, I fell madly in love, like instantly.
Why? What was it about them?
I don't know. Well, okay, some of it was I thought they were quite cute.
Oh, yeah, and they are, and yourself included.
I think you can't really,
you're all very
thank
cute.
You. I don't think you can take that away from us. We were hot.
Good-looking guys.
And I remember very clearly Frank Van Keeken, who was a kid in the hall at the time, he did a monologue stark naked. And that might have been part of it. What's yeah. ironic is that he quit when I joined.
Yeah.
So he did a nude monologue. They played women. They were out there. And I'd been drifting around. I went to acting school. I wanted to be a serious actor. Then I was trying to do stand-up, but I found the atmosphere so homophobic, I couldn't deal with it. And then the moment I saw The Kids in the Hall, I went, that's what I'm supposed to do. Mm. And I remember saying to Darlene, oh, I'm going to be in that group. And she was like, but you don't even know them. And I'm like, well, and this is how arrogant I was. I went, well, they need me.
Yeah.
And so I took the donuts and I started throwing it at them in the middle of their show. And I ruined their show. I was so adamant that they noticed me. And I just thought, these are punks. They'll like it if I trash their show. And they did. They did. I took a calculated risk, and it worked. I think most people, 99.9% of performers, would not like someone throwing them donuts from the audience, especially donuts that were part of a bit that ruined their show. But these guys liked it.
Yeah.
Or at least Bruce did.
Yeah.
did.
So it shows that it was meant to be.
It was. I swear to you, it was honestly like God said, this is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. And you were the fifth kid in the hall. And you were kind of an outsider because Dave Foley and Kevin MacDonald met in Toronto.
Yes.
And Mark McKinney and Bruce McCullough met in Toronto.
They were two teams, and I'm the bridge.
Yeah, and they joined up, joined forces.
I'm the bridge between those
guys. Yeah. So did it feel like, did you feel kind of uncomfortable? Did you feel like a fifth wheel when you first joined?
Oh, very much. It took me a long, long time to feel that I wasn't.
Well, I'm curious what it was like for you in the writer's room because, as you say, your background was in acting. Was it hard for you to get involved in writing
sketches? Yes, I didn't have a clue what to do. Honestly, no idea. I had no idea how to write sketches or monologues or anything. I had no idea how to write a joke, nothing. Yeah. All I knew was I had to be heard. That was it. I had to be heard, and I didn't care how varnished I was or how raw, I just had to be heard. And then through them, all the years with them, I learned. We taught each other. Like, I learned how to write. I learned how to craft a joke. I also learned how to subsume my personality to the group. And that's very important. Like, I was always a shiner. And I really wasn't a good listener, and I wasn't a good team player. But the troupe broke me down. Mm. Until by the end of it, I became a real team. You have to be. And that's the thing about a troupe dynamic. And maybe there are troupes where there's one person that's the star or that sort of thing, but not with us. We were very adamant, and that might be a Canadian thing, but there was not going to be a star, that the group was the star.
Yeah. Yeah. And that played out that way. In his memoir, Bruce McCullough says that you were a big influence on the way the kids played women. Can you talk about that, how you influenced
I think that's probably true. Well, I hate to use that. I hate that term, gender fluid. But I've never really, I mean, yeah, I see a difference. I know there's a difference. There's a huge difference between men and women. But for me, there was never any question like, will I play a female character? Will I play a male character? They always seemed the same to me. Like, oh, it's just a character. You know, and I think that's quite off. That's a real gay tradition too, for gay men, funny gay men to play women. Yeah. Although we did not borrow from the gay drag. Our drag is not gay drag.
So, Kath, what are you doing this weekend?
What am I doing? What am I doing? Well, I don't have anything planned as such.
Yeah.
What are you doing, Kath?
Well, I'm going to go to one of those popular movies with Jill, Betty, and Beth.
Oh,
then afterwards, go three ways on a large pizza.
Uh-huh.
And maybe watch a couple of hours of TV.
Oh, great.
You want to come?
Oh, no. I've seen everything.
Yeah. Kath, I really wish we did more, you know?
Yep.
Used our free time better, planned more things to do.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like our lives are passing us by and we're not even in them.
Yeah.
So do you want to come?
Oh, no, thanks. I'm in my own groove.
All right.
You know? Okay. Well, whatever you do, have a good weekend.
And maybe part of one of your greatest contributions, let me run this by you, I think maybe is your acting chops, that you helped because the kids, not only were you such great writers, you were like, oh, just the best, my favorite of all sketch comedy troupes in terms of creating and inhabiting these characters.
Yeah, I think because it's Mark that spearheaded bringing me in. Mark really was the one that, he had to force them to let me in. Mm. And I think that's because Mark sees himself as an actor and he saw me as an actor and he wanted the group to be more, to treat acting seriously, because the other three were quite prejudiced against actors. And I think they looked down upon me at the beginning, more for being an actor than for being gay. Mm. They thought acting was like, stupid. But, you know, it's my favorite thing. Disappear into a character is my favorite thing on earth, especially a character that you created or co-created.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing's greater. Yeah. And I think, so maybe it's the acting. I consider Mark the greatest. I wouldn't say the best actor in the group, but he's the most gifted in terms of just being able to do like a voice or an accent or a tone. I'm a much slower build, and I learn much slower than Mark does. I think my characters have depth, but Mark's characters are literally, he can just pull characters out of the ether that he has no relationship to. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm going to play a white Jamaican. Oh, I'm going to play an Australian woman. I can't do that. I have to have been having sex with that Australian for years, or I have to have had my heart broken by someone, you know, before I do it. I think, like, for example, Mark's characters are, they're like, he's just so gifted. He's just such a great mimic, and he can do anything. And yet Mark disappears. Like, he literally disappears. And I think into with my characters, I don't disappear as much. I think you can always see me, which is okay, because I think my characters are all, they're all parts of me.
That's Scott Thompson, the fifth and final member of the Canadian comedy troupe, The Kids in the Hall. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the kids are having a moment right now. Actually, it's more than one moment. It's 8 new episodes of groundbreaking, smart, and hilarious humor, like this.
Good morning, that was Melanie and Brand New Key, and this is your friendly neighborhood DJ, Mike Motormouth Mulcahy, on KROC, the Crocodile, rolling out the rock to whoever's left in whatever's left of the greater metropolitan area. The weather today is mostly lethal, so stay indoors. And by indoors, we mean underground in a secure bunker or an abandoned mine. Well, enough chitter-chatter, let's get at her. This is Motormouth in the Morning. Ready or not, here I rock.
Dave Foley is another kid in the hall. You also may remember him from the NBC hitcom News Radio. He took some time out of his busy schedule to tell us what it was like to get the troupe and their comedy paper back together again.
It was a mix of absolute joy in terms of just making each other laugh uncontrollably and hard. The laughter I experience when I'm with the kids in the hall is more intense than I think any other time in my life. And so it was a mix of that and the mix of just how awful we can be to each other at the same time. We've never allowed any time for feelings in our process, as we say in Canada. It was less emotionally violent than the old days.
Well, that's good to hear. What can you tell us about the new Kids in the Hall series?
If you were a fan of the old show, which one of the nice things about being in a group is that I can even be a fan of the old show because there's four other guys responsible for it, then I think you'll like it. It's very much, I think, true to the nature and spirit of the original. It's hard to describe because all we ever tried to do is make the other four guys laugh. And as an extension of that, it seems to make other people laugh. And that's kind of the model that we're still following.
Pardon me? Yes, my drop average is the lowest in the city. And I don't mean to toot my own horn, but it is third lowest in North America.
Well, that's great, but I'm not entirely sure.
What my wife is trying to get at, and excuse our ignorance, doctor, but what exactly is drop average?
Oh, well, a drop average is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It is the average amount of times during the delivery of a newborn that there is droppage.
You drop babies?
Does a bear shit in the woods? Or a more apt question would be, does a doctor drop a newborn baby in the delivery room? And the answers are yes and yes.
You've said that the new series will have a very low quotient of nostalgia, but am I right to think that this low quotient of nostalgia could include the return of Dean Dean and Lex Hare?
So, did you bring my videos?
Slipped my mind.
Should I even ask about The Godfather?
Don't bother.
Man, this is starting to cost me money, you know. I mean, sure, the video store is going to be on my ass, and rightly so, because when you rent a video, you enter into a sacred trust.
I'll tell you what. Let's have dinner tonight. Pesto's at 8. I'll bring the video. I'll bring The Godfather. You know the Paul Simon album you've been wanting me to tape?
Yes.
I'll tape it and bring that, too. And dinner's on me.
You don't have to bother with all that. Just bring me the video.
No, I want to. I'm just sick about the whole thing.
Okay. Pesto's at 8.
Will do.
I love those characters.
Oh, yeah, me too.
But we didn't come up with anything new for those. I think we started trying to write one at one point, but we weren't that happy with it. Part of never writing to any kind of a mandate, even our hit characters, really, we did very few of any of them. We didn't repeat a lot of our hit characters. I think there was probably, like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 Simon and Hecubuses over a 5-year span. you know, another show might have done 5 or 6 in a season.
Good evening, Hecubus. Are you ready?
I am ready to serve you, Master. And Satan.
Good. Then let the proof of evil begin.
Yeah, there's only a handful of head crushers, really, if you count them.
Hey! Old lady! I'm crushing your head!
I beg your pardon?
I'm just crushing the heads that need to get crushed, like yours, madam.
My head is perfectly fine, thank you.
No, it's not. It's shaped like an acorn. Can I flatten it for you? Wish, wish, wish.
No.
Oh, yeah, certain shows, live shows might have done 5 or 6 in a season and actually turned them into films as well.
Yeah, yeah.
In their book, Mondo Canuck, our fellow Canadians Jeff Pevere and Greg Diamond wrote, quote, that so many people didn't get what the kids were doing simply confirms the troupe's validity as something legitimately innovative and subversive, unquote. What do you think of this idea?
That's nice. It was unintentional. When we first got our TV show, we thought we'd be a breakout hit. We thought the masses would swarm to us because we were young and arrogant. It took us time to realize that what we were doing was different. You know, we were really just, you know, in our club shows, just, again, just trying to make each other laugh. And as a result, that it became a cult thing in Toronto, where we suddenly had this huge audience in Toronto just from these nightclub shows. We never thought we were being subversive or edgy or anything like that. We just thought we were funny. You know, we thought we were the funniest thing in the world.
You were right to think that, but I'm surprised you didn't realize, though, you knew you were funny, but you didn't think you were being subversive?
Well, we didn't. It wasn't subversive to us. It was just telling the jokes that were funny to us. It was just doing comedy that wasn't boring to us. Mm. That was in the zeitgeist of that time, you know, of the early and mid-80s. There was that sort of punk mentality of just whatever you do, just don't be boring, you know, just don't do the same crap that everyone else has been doing.
Yeah. Yeah. You've accomplished so much already. I'm curious about whether there's anything that you haven't done yet that you're still yearning to do. Maybe a memoir, maybe a one-man show, a la Bruce McCullough's Tales of Bravery and Stupidity.
Well, a memoir, I'm hampered by having both a terrible memory and having spent a huge chunk of my life blackout drunk. I've had so many blackout drunks that my autobiography is going to be called Hearsay. I probably won't do a memory unless I actually do just get everyone else to tell me stories about my life that I don't remember. I'd like to direct more. I haven't, that would be nice. I mean, I really liked directed some of the film pieces on the Old Kids in the Hall show and directed on News Radio and directed a Christmas special for CBC years ago. Mm. So I'd like to do more of that.
Yeah. And you wouldn't want to combine, like, would you want to combine writing, directing, and acting, or would that just be too overwhelming? Yeah.
No. That's like the most fun. But also just directing stuff that isn't me would be fun too.
Yeah. Yeah. Dave Foley, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And thanks to you and your fellow kids for giving us so many laughs for so many years. And we'll get a bunch more laughs when we see the new series.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Dave Foley is a member of the Kids in the Hall. We also heard from his fellow kid, Scott Thompson, a bit earlier. The troupe's new Prime Video series is available for streaming now. So what are you waiting for? Find out more about Scott, Dave, and the rest of the kids at wpr.org/beta. Sounds like you're still waiting.
This can be frank. I see no curls. I see no demon. I see nothing. I see a businessman.
Author Coda Clute tells us the remarkable story of how being a Frank Zappa fan led him to an unexpected friendship with the famous musician. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Coda Clute is a Dutch journalist. He's also a music producer and a maker of radio and TV documentaries. When Co was a young lad, his life changed dramatically. Why? Because he heard this. Who are the brave police? That's music from Freak Out, the 1966 debut album by the Mothers of Invention, featuring Frank Zappa. Coe became an instant fan of Frank's music, and a few years later found himself face to face with Frank himself for a short interview. The result was the beginning of a friendship that lasted until Zappa's death in 1993. Coe eventually became a radio producer and even worked on a few projects with Zappa over the years. Now Coe has transcribed his chats with Zappa into a book titled Frank and Coe, Conversations with Frank Zappa, 1977 to 1993. The book not only gives insight into the mind of Frank, but also chronicles the growth of a friendship between the two men. But as Coe tells our very own Steve Gotcher, it all goes back to that day when Coe dropped the needle on that first album.
So I played that record over and over again at the age of 12. My musical life changed instantly. And I said, what is this? I don't get it. I don't understand it, but there's something to it that I must explore. And then within a few weeks, my father said, hey, listen, you've been playing that album by the Mothers of Invention so much. It's pretty old. It's already 5-6 years old, but here's a new one. And he handed me 200 Motels. So I put that on the record player. I can honestly say it changed my life and laid down a path for me to follow musically. And I was overwhelmed. And that was in 1971, I think, 71, 72. And then in 73, I saw Frank live for the first time in concert. And then it was all settled. And then I said to myself, when I went home, I was totally in shock because it was a mainly instrumental show. And I went home and I was totally confused. And I said, if ever I get to meet this man, I'm going to tell him what an impact this show had on my life. Not knowing that 4 years later, we became friends.
Yeah, so you're like the embodiment of every real music lover's dream, because we all think about what it would be like to get to know one of our musical heroes, and you did that and became friends. That's amazing. Now, you first interviewed Frank in 1977 when you were 18 years old. You must have been really nervous. Tell me about that experience.
It was the weirdest thing. I've described it in the book, but it was the weirdest thing. My father had arranged for me that I could be present at a session that he had in a hotel talking to some people from the press. Because my father knew the promo guy from Warner Brothers really well. And he says, hey, Jan, can you take Co and maybe he can say hi to Frank? So I brought a cheapo tape recorder and my mother's camera. And I went to the hotel. And the promo guy said, sit in the lobby and wait for me because you never know what's going to happen. I'll try to get you your seconds to shake hands and get an autograph, but that's it. Then two guys walk in and they look really freaky. And one of them had long hair and a mustache and a goatee. And I thought to myself, is this Frank? No, he's too fat to be Frank. So... Or is he? So I was really puzzled. And of course, I was very nervous. The slide door of the little hotel lobby opened. A guy walks in with hair like an Italian businessman, a small mustache, tiny goatee, an extremely expensive jacket, and a business suitcase. An Italian manager, CEO type looking guy. And I was so baffled and nervous. And I said, this can be Frank. I see no curls. Mm-hmm. I see no demon. I see nothing. I see a businessman. And he looks at me. And all I could say is, are you Frank Zappa? And he looks at me like, who is this? And where's my bodyguard? And he says, I sure am. He goes into the elevator and away he is. And I thought, oh, I blew it. The Warner guy comes in and says, now, come with me. So we go up, and just when everybody was leaving, the Warner Brother guy says, Frank, can I introduce you to somebody? This is Coe. His father's name is also Coe, and he's a very important radio guy for us. And Coe is probably one of your biggest fans in Holland. And Frank looks at me and he says, and you still had to ask if it was me when you saw me in the lobby? And I said, And he says, "You were just being careful, huh?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Okay, relax." And then I could ask some questions. And then I had this interview. And we had a very nice talk. And then I said goodbye and I'll see you at the show tomorrow, blah, blah, blah.
What happened that made it possible for you to win Frank's trust? Do you know when that moment came?
My answer would be, I might be the first person to have asked him, "Are you Frank Zappa?"
And thus he trusted you.
Because most of the people who met him knew, and I just wasn't sure.
Did you ever think in your wildest dreams that you would become friends? Was that a goal in your life, or just evolved?
It evolved. It evolved in a way that he started to see me as a constant factor when I was here. One of the things I like so much about Zappa is that he was extremely interested in people. And when he found out that I wanted to go to the conservatory, but that I also wanted to be a producer, he gave me a break that is really like a dream. In 1980, the radio station that my father was attached to got the rights to record his show in Rotterdam. Frank, through his then manager, Bennett Glatzer, said, "There's two demands. I want a copy of all the multi-tracks, and I want my friend Co to be the supervisor of the mix." And the people that I knew at Far Radio says, "What? You're 21 years old. You're just a conservatory student who wants to be a producer. And Zappa asked you to supervise his mix." And maybe it was just a joke for Frank and to give me a break. I spent 3 days, and the engineer was happy that I was there because I knew the music. Mm-hmm. So I could cue him all the way. So the mix went very fast. So I had my first job for Frank.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so over the next few years, you recorded conversations with Frank, which you transcribed in your book. And you even worked with him now and then on various projects. And then you became friends over the years. And then during a phone conversation in 1989, Frank told you that he had cancer. How did you react to that?
I was baffled, especially the way he said it. He just said it like extra after a long conversation. He said, "Oh, by the way, yeah, I got cancer." And I was shocked and I said, "Can it be treated?" And we'll see. And that was it. Those are moments that you are going to start to think back. Here was this teenager in Amsterdam doing his first interview, and now your idol telling you that he is very sick.
Mm. Yeah. In 1990, you went to the Utility Muffin Research Kitchen, UMRIC, as some people call it, and recorded several days of conversations with Frank in the studio. Tell me about that experience.
Well, he knew that I was going to make a four-hour radio special in Holland called Supplements, which would air on his 50th birthday. So it was a birthday celebration, and we already had agreed that at the end of the show, which ran from 8 till midnight, we would call him and say happy birthday. So I did all these interviews with him. He gave me a lot of exclusive audio material. And so we constructed this whole program. And those days were very inspiring. He was extremely nice to us. And he had to take breaks because he was not feeling well. But for the rest, it was just fun and a great experience.
Frank passed away on December 4th, 1993, but that previous summer, you flew to L.A. to see your friend one last time. Tell me about that meeting, if you can.
You know, when you have relatives or friends in your neighborhood or in your inner circle that you know are not well and may die, you see them often and you try to see them as often as you can. But if somebody lives on the other side of the planet, you know that if he's really ill and you're going to see him, when you say goodbye, it's going to be the last time. Mm-hmm. So I went over and Frank was there. And the last time I saw him was a year before in Frankfurt. I walk into the basement. He's sitting there with a cigarette in his hand and he's very, very skinny, has a long beard. The first word he says to me is, "Relax," because he thought I was shocked about what I saw. Now, I have to go back to the book because in the book, there's a little snippet, a little piece of paper where Frank had written down in 1979 his home address. And he gave it to me. That's why I'm very happy that I saved it. And he gave it to me and he said, no matter what you're going to do in your life or what your business will be, at this address, there will always be a cup of coffee for you. That is a moment you don't forget. I was invited to Frank's house for a cup of coffee, and this is his address, you know. So here's this 18-year-old fan being very happy with a little piece of paper. Fast forward 93, I'm in the basement. He offered me some coffee. Gail was walking in and out. Dweezil was walking in and out. At one instance, we were alone. And he says to me, so how's business? How's the radio thing going? How's your own music going? He knew I was a musician. I said, well, it's cool. Great. Menno says hi. And he says, so what's your business here in LA? And I say, well, I came to see you. And he says, yeah, I know you're here, but what are you doing? Are you going to interview people or what is it for the radio that you're doing? And I said, no, I'm not here for my work. I'm here to see you. And then he looked at me and I just could see him thinking, wait a minute. He lives 20 minutes drive from Amsterdam. This is LA. Did this guy take all the effort just to be here for half hour? And he got irritated when I didn't respond what my work was. He said, I know you're here, but what is your business here? I said, I don't have any business. I'm just here to be with you. And that baffled him somewhat. And then he says, oh, wait a minute. You came for that cup of coffee. And that is one of the most intense moments of my life. I said, how can you remember that? A person who meets 500 people a day, handing me a note in 79, inviting me for a coffee, and referring to it as that cup of coffee. And I said, Frank, you... And then he said again, relax. So we stood up. I gave him a hug. And I felt how fragile, how what's the English word?
Frail.
Frail he was. So I didn't know what to say. So I said, okay, I got to go now. And I said, I'll see you next time.
Yeah.
And he said, sure. And that was it.
It's been 30 years since Frank passed away, and yet his music is still as vital, seemingly, as it was when he was still around. Do you think his musical legacy will continue into the years?
Yes, because it's of an yet to be really discovered quality. I had the big advantage of being with him. Mm-hmm. So I call myself some sort of a connoisseur on his music. And sometimes I just sit and I say, how can anybody of that age write something this beautiful? This man was such an incredible force of creativity and insight and intelligence combined that it's, sometimes for me it's just baffling. How can you write Duke of Prunes and then turn around and write Big Like Emma? What is in his mind? That is a message to us. And the message to us is that music is universal. There's no such thing as high or low culture. To make the circle round, when you asked me in the beginning, what was it that you heard in Frank's music as a young boy that attracted you so much? It's the honesty. It's honesty without compromise. Mm.
Well said. Cody Clute, thanks so much for talking with us today, and thanks for your book, Frank and Co. It's an intimate and insightful look at one of the greatest composers of our time.
And I want to add one thing, if I may.
Please.
There's a lot of people who helped me with this book. There was a lot of audio that had to be transcribed literally. So I needed a native speaker to transcribe it. And one of your listeners is a friend of mine who is very, very, very important for me in the creation of this book. Dave Pearson from Menominee, if it hadn't been for him, the book wouldn't be here. So right. I want to thank Dave, and I'm very happy that I know at least one of your faithful listeners.
That's great. That's great to hear. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the time.
Cody Clute is the author of Frank and Co., Conversations with Frank Zappa, 1977
to 1993. He spoke with Beta Steve Gotcher. Find out more about Coe's friendship with Frank at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, John Waters, Scott Thompson, Dave Foley, and Coe DeClute. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, head over to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast catcher and click subscribe, follow, and like. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Some people say that he joined a Kiss cover band and he rocks three nights a week in some chicken wings bar.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
My empire is crumbling!
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
You're not a plate of croissants.